Welcome to another episode of Respecting the Beer. My name is Gary Arday. With me, as usual, is Bobby Fleshman and Allison McCoy. How are you guys doing?
Great.
Excellent. Fantastic. We've talked about beer generally. We've talked about your story. This episode, before you even get into tasting a beer, there is a presentation. You see it, you smell it, and that's what we want to talk about today, because every beer has a unique color. It has a unique scent. How it's presented can be totally different. So let me start out with the most basic question. Where does the color in beer come from?
Such a good question. Bobby, take it away.
And to phrase it another way, why do beers have a different color?
Right. So most of us are familiar with beer having sort of yellow all the way to black hues. And there's also an intensity related to that. So there's two questions here. What's the color? And then how do you get that intensity? So here comes Allison.
So I'm a chemistry professor, so I'm going to throw in some chemistry bits here and there. This is one of the most epic things. Beer gets its color from Beer's Law. And this is a legit chemistry thing. It's actually called the Beer-Lambert Law. And you've experienced this before. When you have a really very weak cup of coffee, it's going to be a lot lighter brown. And if you have a really strong bit of coffee or a cup of coffee, it's going to be much, much, much darker. So that's called the Beer-Lambert Law. And this is named after August Beer of like 1800 or so. He's an English chemist. And basically, the more stuff in the water, the more light gets absorbed. And so that means it becomes darker. And so has nothing to do with actual beer. The guy's name actually originates from, I think, the word shire from England. Not quite sure. Anyway, but Beer's Law says that the more materials in the beer that absorb light, the darker it's going to be. And that material comes from the malt. Bobby, your cue.
Right. So historically, the way beer was made was, you'll recall, barley was taken. Before that, there were other grains. But I guess in modern history, barley's taken and it is germinated. And that's just where that barley gets sprouted and in water. It gets tricked into thinking there's a rain. And then we halt that process and eventually turn that into malt by drying it out and sometimes kilning it. And that kilning process is what gives you the colors and aromas that we associate with beer with beer, one of the main components. The exact colors that come out of that process are determined by at what temperature that barley becoming malt is being germinated or kilned at.
So higher temperature, dark color.
Right. Yeah. And also more protein. So you have different levels of proteins in the various grains and varieties of barley, and you get a different outcome based on the level of protein. And there are these molecules that end up in the end product that interfere with light as you look
at it. It's not really interfere. It's more of an absorbance.
Absorbance.
Thank you.
Yeah. So that Allison can speak to the science exactly behind it, but you get different molecules depending on what level of protein you have in that barley. And so throughout time, for a variety of reasons, the brewing industry has looked for the perfect barley, not just in this context, but in other ones. And oftentimes, one of the key parameters is level protein. So though really, it's about heat and time and then sort of protein levels. And then there's some stuff that happens in brewing itself. There's ways of making that malt turn into wort, turn into beer. And the small details by which different breweries make their beer gives you different colors. Whether that be direct fire with heat or using steam, there are ways you can affect the outcome in that context too. Modern times, people are loving fast forward many hundreds of years, and people are loving hazies these days, hazy IPAs, and that color is really opaque, and so now we're talking about a very different thing. That contribution is coming from yeast and hops, and it's what we call adjuncts like oats and wheats and so forth. But that's your core background behind colors.
So you have something like so when you said the proteins, is that what's absorbing the light?
Yes, and. So part of the proteins, but then also part of the other kind of off products or additional products that'll be in the malt. And so you're going to have so many different molecules that comprise it that any one of them can be a culprit of absorbing a little bit of light, and then you add them all together and then they're going to absorb a lot more.
So if you take a lager, which is traditionally a very light colored beer, and a stout, It's a very dark beer, totally opaque. Is it the same stuff that, but there's just more of it in a stout, or is it completely different stuff? And let's then, just for the heck of it, throw in, if you have an amber lager, which is, you know,
great
in the lager family, but a different shade of color. Is that just, as again, is it something else that's making the amber lager a different color, or is it just more stuff of the same?
Yes and yes.
Yeah, when you go past the kilning process, which gives you those colors I mentioned, you get into what's called roasting. And roasting is taking it even higher temperatures. And I was going to mention that a minute ago. I missed it. To roast something really creates a dangerous scenario where you can have flames burst out. So this is sort of a modern...
When flames burst out, let's talk about when. So this is at the malting process.
Yeah, this is post-malting. Well, it's sort of past the drying and the germination phases of malting. You can move into what's known as a roasting drum or other apparatus that allow you to take grain up to many hundreds of degrees. And if you don't have that control, you'll have fires every other day. So you're actually looking at something that was created in the last few hundred years, or less than 200 years for sure. It's the industrial age. And you see Guinness, you see stouts, and you see these various black beers being created after we had control of that. So those malts are actually cooked to a very dark level. Sometimes they're using raw barley. They just skip the malt altogether, just incinerate it. So you can almost take, what I said about the protein level and throw it out the window when you're talking about taking things to that level of roast.
Oh, that would make sense. Why the heads are different then at the darker beers.
Exactly. Yeah. Ooh. We use raw barley there.
Learning on
different
the fly.
Protein compositions. Yeah, absolutely. Now you can take a raw barley and roast it, or you can take a malt. And
side story,
it.
We'll get to it later. I just had this realization because the more protein that you have in a beer, the bigger the head is going to be. So the foam on the top. And so less protein means you're going to have less foam. And I'm just now realizing that's one of the reasons our dark beers have less foam, unless it's nitro. But then we'll get to that.
Right. Yeah, I don't want to go off on that. Red
That'll
hole,
be yeah. in a yeah. polar episode.
Hold on,
yeah.
hold off. I'm at the edge of my yeah. seat. This mm-hmm. is exciting.
Oh, but you asked. So that's the one extreme. That's how you make a stout. Then actually, chronologically, came light, like Pilsners and Helles. That actually came after your Guinness or your Irish stouts and so on, because that required a different technological hurdle be overcome. And that was where, how do you cook? How do you do this germination and kilning at a degree that leaves no color?
So cook without burning?
Yeah, cook without burning. And so they would use coke, which was derived from coal, and it has minimum impurities, and it allows you to make something that's not, quote, a smoked malt, whereas in the days prior, it might have been wood used to generate the heat, and every malt coming off the kiln might taste smoky.
I don't necessarily know that I like smoky beers.
There's another whole topic there, smoky smoke styles.
I think it covers some of the beauty and the malt flavor.
Right, right. But when you overcome that, you can make the lighter colored malts, and the English began making pale ales, dark, lighter and lighter beers that they called pale. They might have been actually amber by today's standards, but that was taken even farther with German Helles and Czech Pilsners.
Well, if I remember correctly, it was such a rarity and it was much more expensive to do, that folks who could afford to get these pale lager, pale ales or pails, would actually then like showcase them in fancy glassware and stuff to show the world that they were like, hey, look, I can afford the fancy beer now. Doesn't have to be like the lower level beer, which was the dark stuff.
Right. So in the middle of all that, you can get ambers. You can do this in a couple ways. You can figure out a way to roast or not roast. You can do that lower temperature kilning to get the colors you're looking to achieve, or maybe that's just an inadvertent outcome, or maybe use a combination of ingredients. Maybe you use all Pilsner malt, the light colored malt, and then you toss in a little bit of roasted barley, and behold, you'll get an Irish red ale. So there are all kinds of things you can do to make that from a recipe standpoint.
So most brewers are probably not going to be roasting their own malt. You're getting this from someone who handles malt. So when you're making a decision of what to brew, and are you looking at different suppliers? Do they have a catalog of different malts and then different roasts? I mean, I'm just thinking of all the different combinations of malts and roastings. That number could get potentially pretty large.
Right. It's infinite, the permutations. And you'll notice I spent a lot of time talking about the guys that make this, the women that make these ingredients upstream, the maltsters, because they deserve that. And rather than all of the blame, which we tend to do as brewers, we tend to blame them for everything that goes wrong. So we do spend a lot of time, and we know where their barley itself comes from. So it matters what the weather patterns are like, and it matters how that farmer does his job.
But not only that, to the point of when you're looking for flavor, but you're also looking for color, because we do taste with our eyes. So there was this really cool color scale, and I don't remember the year. It must have been 1800 something, called the Lavabond scale, which this dude made these little bitty glass plates that are kind of like stained glass, but they were stained the different types of colors of that beer malt could be. And then he would just hold up the little glass plate next to the beer, and then he was like, all right, this is Lavabond 10 or some arbitrary number. But we actually still use that Lavabond scale from this guy that made these little glass plates from back in the day.
Right. And if anyone's familiar with spectra and anything where you try to break down like the colors of what you see in any image, you know, you can't define it by one frequency. So this really was a way of very crudely grouping beer colors, but you can find different beers that to your eyes look very, very different in color, have the same Lavabond. So we've really modernized that and added more dimensions to that. But that was a beginning step.
I wasn't aware of this. So beers have like a spectral fingerprint?
They do.
Yeah, absolutely. Tricolor.
So it's like a star.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. Tricolor stimulus methodology is how it's done today. And no one ever sees, they always see SRM or EBC or Lavabond. There's all these different ways you can.
Lavabond is a really old school one.
You can describe colors, and people look for that. Usually they don't. They usually care more about ABV and IBUs. And
but in the gorgeousness of what quality is in beer, you have to make the exact same product every time, but with the ingredients always changing based on seasonal fluctuations and such. And so to know what your beer color, the end product is, and have a way to like I don't know, as a target to match it, those kind of number systems really do help.
They do. And we're modern. And just in the last couple of years, brewers have been doing what's called hot steep methods. And they take little handfuls of malt and they make little bitty batches of what will become ultimately their beer. And from that, they can take all the unknowing of what's happened upstream, and they can determine what the color will be of the finished beer, and they can adjust the quantities and so on.
And let me just give a personal shout out to how much I hate the hot steep method, because you will come to me and hand me a glass of beer. And you're like, hey, try this. And I'm, of course, thinking it's something that's been fermented and such, but it's his hot steep method. And so it's this weird, watery, murky mix of pre-ingredients, for lack of a better phrase, that haven't done any of the fermentation or malting or boiling or anything like that. And it's this weird, complex, eh. And he's like, can't you taste it? It's great. And I was like, why are you doing this to me?
Yeah, you got to taste through the sugar to see what's there. Yeah.
I do not have that skill yet. So anyway, so whoever invented that method.
Would I be right in assuming that a very large brewer would probably have equipment on site to measure the color?
Yeah.
And I'm guessing as a smaller brewery, you probably are not doing that.
No, we actually do have access to ways of doing that, but it's about resources and time. The really, really large breweries, they have beer delivered by rail car, you know, by the hundreds. And what those guys will do is in real time, they'll be able to take a representative sample, and they'll be able to run all their analysis while the train car waits. And if it doesn't pass, it goes to a cattle ranch. So that's a whole other level, but yes, you can
for
do
the
it.
Cows to drink and eat, not
exactly.
Necessarily
I mean,
for the
difference between
these cattle ranches.
It's amazing. The difference between a malting and a feed barley or a feed malt is incredible when you think about it. This one decision is made, and then all this grain goes to these cattle as opposed to a beer. Or maybe there's another brewer that will take it. But
very happy
cows. Yeah, these decisions are made far, far up.
So we talked about color and color. And here's one of the weird things is like sometimes you really want a clean beer. And like you mentioned, sometimes you have a hazy beer or sometimes you have a dark beer. So it isn't necessarily like you're trying to achieve any certain goal. It's sort of just an arbitrary, this is what we're shooting for. This is what we're going to go for. And I also mentioned that because of these differences in color, the creation of light beers, glassware kind of developed around it. So you could actually see the beer. You guys serve beers in particular glasses, I've noticed. That if I order, you know, a 547 from you, which is your signature double IPA, comes in a particular type of glass.
Mm-hmm.
If I get a one of your lagers comes in a different type of glass. If I get a Pilsner, it comes in a different type of glass. Why? Why? And why that glass?
First of all,
is it arbitrary that you...
Apologies to our staff, first of all, because we are obsessed with glassware, and it's kind of difficult for them to deal with once in a while.
But, although, also, yeah. they should say thank you to us, because we don't go as extreme as we can.
right.
So we reduced it down to just four different glasses. When we first opened the brewery, we had 10 different glasses. Now we've got it down to 4, so it's manageable. Well, really 5. But Gary's right. So if you order a German lager from us, we want that to be nice and cold. We want it to be clear and gorgeous, and we want it to have a really nice head on top. So we will typically put that in what's called a seidel, which is, you're familiar with the big beer steins, like the glass mug type thing that's really big. Half liter.
Yep.
That's called a seidel. Technically, a stein would be earthenware, so the thick ceramic. And that's so you don't have any light struck, because lagers, particularly the light lagers, are very sensitive to sunlight. And so they will go through a reaction that'll typically yield the same kind of molecule that skunks bless us with on occasion. And so we want to keep those suckers, the beers, protected from light. And so that's why a earthenware stein would be best for those. But our glassware is actually really thick, so that's going to help insulate and maintain the temperature longer. It's also going to have a tall spot at the top so that the head can be retained longer.
Yeah, this feels like a topic to do in person rather than a podcast, because people want to have it in front of them. And they want to be able to smell and see these different effects that these different glasses
have. But much like for folks in the wine world, you have a different glass for the reds and the whites. And the reds will typically have, and the same thing with IPAs, you want to focus some of those aromatics, which are the molecules that come to your nose really easily. And so for the IPAs, we'll want a glass that's going to concentrate those smells, because that's where the most of the experience of the beer is going to come from. Whereas the ales, they don't really have that much smell to offer. It's much more in the flavor or in the taste with your tongue. And so those come in these like much wider mouth, big old mug.
And they come in these glasses, usually they're called nonics or no nicks, and they don't stick together when you stack them, and they don't get scratched except on the outer bulge of that nick or that of that nonic section. And we have those, and they still make those. And they're sort of an upgrade to what are called shaker pints.
Which are just like the angled traditional American never drink a beer from that. That's what for water is for. Oh my gosh.
We can go on and on about that.
I get so mad when I see beer served in those things.
Look for the cheater glasses out there. There are often these shaker pints you get your beers in, and the bottom 2 ounces is full of glass. So you're not getting as much as you think you are. That happens.
But one thing I can say is never under any circumstances should you have a beer in a frozen or frosted glass. That is just so disrespectful to the beer. Or
why?
Why? Oh, this is a good question. So cold things, well, when you warm something up, the molecules are going to leave and come to your nose faster. And so if you keep it cold, basically what you're doing is you're subduing the beer's ability to get to your nose. And so if you've got any off flavors or anything that you want to hide, keep it colder. If you want to really experience it, warm it up a bit. So if you chill the glass, you're actually covering up something associated with the beer.
In my business hat says, drink it however you want it, except make sure the glass is clean. That's my biggest thing. Your lines are clean. The glass is clean. If you choose to have it out of a frozen mug, I've gone through that evolution myself, then knock yourself out. But yeah,
I personally don't
prefer it, but definitely make sure your glasses are clean and free of detergent, and that your lines are clean that you're getting your beer from.
We didn't talk about this before the show, but let me ask you, temperature. You mentioned that there's some beers are in some countries are served warm.
Yeah.
Some are served cold. How do you determine the temperature at which a beer is to come through the tap?
I rely first on, we build our styles based, most of our styles, our beers are based on styles that are historical. So I rely on history there. Most of these beers, the recipes have evolved according to what temperatures were they had access to. And so I follow that lead. And once in a while, we'll tweak on that. But we start with what's known to be a good lager temp.
And there really aren't a huge variety of temperatures. We really just go with two. I mean, there's the ale temperature and the lager temperatures. And the ale temperatures for our cask condition, we'll put it at cellar temperatures, which is 54.
Yeah, we'll put it about 50 in the room. By the time it hits the glass, it's about 53 or 4.
Yeah. And so it's, quote, warm, but it's not warm like room temperature warm. It's just going to be much warmer than the really cold lagers.
And we do not keep our lager, if you want to call it our lager cooler, we don't keep that cold. There are bars that will run theirs at 32 degrees. You can bring beer down to, if it has 5% alcohol, you can bring it down to at least 25 degrees. But you do see sub-freezing. You see sub-32 out there. We don't do that. We do something like 38. And then when it hits your glass, it's about 40 to 41.
Let's end this discussion with something that Allison brought up about foam and a head. You mentioned protein, which actually made sense because I used to have a coral reef aquarium and I had to have a protein skimmer for it.
Oh.
And you just basically, I mean, it wasn't as enticing as the head on a beer, but it was kind of gross actually and smelled. But
protein fish water, yum.
But you see this on the sea, right? If you're ever on the coast of the ocean, you'll sometimes see sea foam. So I never really put two and two together that's kind of what basically was on a beer. But I suppose the question is, some beers have different types of heads.
Right.
Is that a decision or is that just an effect of what happens? And the other thing, the staff who works here, some of them are very, very fussy about trying, you know, this is part of the ceremony of trying to get a perfect head of beer.
I love those.
Where they will literally take photos and try to create, the perfect pour.
Compete against each other.
I liken it to at a restaurant, you plate the food according to what it is supposed to look like at any good restaurant. Same with beer. It's got to be in the right glass to the right level, the right amount of foam. It's going to be absolutely pristine in terms of cleanliness.
So one of the temperature. Our public house pint, Irish Stout. So that one, it's a nitro beer. It's got this beautiful creamy head to it. The bubbles are teeny, teeny, tiny because they're nitrogen-based bubbles as opposed to CO2-based bubbles. But the thing is that if they don't pour it, the perfect pour involves one big bubble. And if they don't hit it just right with the last way that they use the nozzle, because you can either pull the nitro tap towards you or away from you, and that's how you control.
It's like putting your thumb on the water hose.
Yeah.
Is how I describe it and how you put your thumb on that water hose.
And then there's like, if you push it away from you, then that's the finishing touch foam. And if you don't do it perfectly timed, you get this one big bubble in the middle. And it's just like so devastating when you're pouring this perfect pint and you're like, yes, here it goes. And then you get, damn it, you got the bubble.
And Guinness, as good as they are, Guinness is really good about certifying their servers for almost everywhere their beer is seen. And as good as they are, I see them getting butchered all the time. Guinness itself gets butchered all the time.
Although one of our staff can draw a shamrock with the last foam nozzle on the nitro beers. She's incredible. She's just like an artist when it comes to the fancy. It's kind of like the coffee, the latte, where they make the little cream part look like flowers or something like that.
Yeah, we're going to mix technology with the past and do 3D printing. Or what's that laser etching on the foam as it goes out? That's happening now.
I've been to several places in Ireland, including the Guinness Brewery.
Yeah.
And a couple other places where they have, people who've been trained and they show you how to pour a Guinness properly and everything.
Yep.
And
you got to wait for it.
Yeah. It's not something that happens right away. But
no.
But you don't have a training. This is just sort of an organic thing, it seems like, with a lot of the staff here where they've just sort of developed.
It depends on whether I've shadowed them enough or not, because they get nervous when I'm around because I'm kind of a freak show about it.
He calls me out all the time. It frustrates me to no end because some beers I can pour really well, but then others I just avoid pouring because I know Bobby's going to give me the side eye. That's not right.
Now, maybe this is something for a future episode, but I've always likened that element of beer to the opening a bottle of wine. Mm. Like there's a ceremony involved, a certain tradition. And you can have wine in a box or do something else and I've seen arguments that maybe it doesn't affect the taste or anything like that, and that's fine. But it's kind of part of what you get when you get a bottle of wine. And when you get a beer, having that foam and the pouring of it is sort of part of the ceremony of ordering a beer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the theme was tasting with your eyes of this podcast and nose and so on. And I think that being the first sip, so to speak, the foam matters.
Well, it matters to the last sip too, because you can tell really clean glassware by what's called lacing. So the foam.
Also bubbles
on
the side of your glass.
Well, that's what lacing is.
Yeah, they're related.
Goodness. Oh, bring it. Anyway, so when you have an empty glass, you basically have these rings of foam that remain. If the glass is really clean, you have much more distinct rings of foam, and if the glass is dirty, it almost disappears instantly.
You can also tell who's drinking faster by the spacing of those lines.
Mm-hmm.
The glassware, we're gonna have a separate episode where we're gonna talk about bubbles and carbonation, but just to address it here, glassware obviously has a lot to do with the bubbles,
mm-hmm.
because the activation sites for it are gonna all be found in the glass. Have you noticed that there's certain types of glassware that are more conducive to having bubbles escape in the beer?
Well, we, and I'm kicking this idea around, we don't have any etched glassware. I think it'd be cool if we did. You see this a lot of times where you'll see a logo of a whatever, a brewery or a bar, the bottom of that glass, and they're teeny tiny little scratches, and they serve as what are called nucleation sites. And that's places where the pressure drops by the folding the molecule. Allison's the physical chemist. She can explain it. But basically,
yep.
you're driving CO2 bubbles out of solution. And then once they break free at that point, they rise. And when they rise, they get bigger. And when they get bigger, they rise faster and so forth. So you can actually create a cascade effect of bubbles replenishing fully all the time. We don't have that. That would be really cool. But to your point, if we're going to pour a...
Actually, no. Because if we had that, they would be more likely in our lagers, and our lagers go in the steins, which are dimpled steins, which you can't really see through them anyway. So only in the Hildy, only in the Pilsner glass.
Right. It all depends on what your goals are. If you want that head to be there, regardless if someone's taking a...
Only you would want the bubbles to cascade the way they're supposed to when we can't even see it. You're like, yeah, but they are there, I promise. Yes,
maybe. But there's aromatic effects too. But I think that when we're thinking about a Weizen, we're thinking about a lot of foam, and it'll stay for the high levels of protein involved. You'll see a Hefeweizen foam stack stay longer. So you need more room for the foam for like a Hefeweizen. You don't need nearly so much with your English beers. You need about one finger's worth of room for those. So there's two extremes there.
All right. So we're going to wrap this episode up. You're at a bar. You order a beer. Visually, before you taste it, before you smell it, what should someone be looking for, either as a good sign or a bad sign?
I'll take the bad.
Yep.
Okay. There's three ways right off the bat. If it's poured to the absolute brim, that's generally not, in fact, almost, I would say never, is that a good thing, even though there's maybe value seen. Number two, you see little bubbles on the side of the inside of that glass. That means there's impurities. It wasn't clean prior. Number three, I guess I'll stop with those two. I think I'm missing one, but that'll work.
Yeah, no foam is bad.
Yeah, no foam.
Bubbles
is
on the side of the glass,
the
very
top.
Bad.
Yeah.
But I think the other thing, so what should you be looking for? You should be looking for about a thumb's width of foam to two thumbs width or two fingers width of foam, depending on the style of beer. But you should have at least a minimum of fingers width of foam around the top of the glass. Preferably, all of that foam is homogeneous, so there's not like one big-ass bubble on the side and a bunch of little bitty bubbles. It should all be about the same. The other thing you should look for is that, depending on the beer style, it's either gorgeously clear or it's the same consistency throughout the whole thing. Basically, that the beer looks like something that you would want to take a picture of, and hopefully you do.
And not to judge, but avoid shaker pints, avoid the frozen glass.
No frozen
glass. But not
glassware.
To judge.
So, and for a finger's width, is that metric or imperial?
Oh, that's a good question. Depends on where you're from.
All right. Well, I think that concludes another episode of Respecting the Beer. Join us next week for another episode. And until then, you can go to our Patreon page or our Facebook group, the links to which can be found in the show notes.
Go team.